Patricia Camilleri, and in this series called Talking Books, I shall be asking my guests about their personal relationship with the written word. I'm delighted to have with me today Vincent Vella. Vincent studied at the University of Malta and the University of Exeter, UK, and he now works at the University of Malta as Director of Studies on the Foundation Studies course. He is, of course, a writer of short stories, novels and plays, and some of his works have won prizes both locally and abroad. His short story, Guilt, won the European Short Story Competition in 1995. Revenge was a runner-up for the Europe and Canada region in the Commonwealth Foundation Short Story Competition organised by the Commonwealth Broadcasting Association in 1996. As regards drama, Vincent has placed among the winners in four editions of the Concours Tal Kitbal Palk, Francis Ebeye. His most notable successes were the three occasions when he was regional winner for Europe in the BBC World Service Radio Playwriting Competition for 1999. Some of his plays have been staged in Malta as well as abroad, and he's published a number of books, among them the novel Inside the Horse, a collection of plays in Maltese by Galia Holm, two collections of short stories, one in Maltese, Hut Wara Hut, and another in English, Mark of Cain, as well as two books for children, Ziffa Oste Yer Ohra, or Donna Zucchetta. A collection of his short stories was published in Slovene as part of the Euroman project on the occasion of Slovenia's accession to the EU presidency in 2008. His hobbies include theatre, obviously, reading, jogging and swimming, how energetic, good wine and food, and cooking. Yes, that sounds really good. And his favourite music, he tells me, is Mozart and also Leonard Cohen, and I would concur on that.
Nothing dates you like your music.
Exactly, that was what I was going to say. Welcome to you.
Thank you, it's nice to be here, Patricia.
Well, when I approached you to join me on this program, you accepted enthusiastically, thank you very much, and you chose several books which are really diverse, and I'm really looking forward to hearing you talk about them. The first one is Herodotus, the histories. What is it about this Herodotus that fascinates you?
I met him when I was 18, which is the right age to meet such a person. You know, I mean, I was fascinated at finding somebody with my own mindset, so to say. I took sociology later at university, which sort of tells you where I'm going to. Because here was a person who said, you can keep your myths, your stories, very interesting, I want to have a look at them, but... So at 18, that's how you go through life. You give it to me, but I'm going to ask questions. And he did. He did. He was one of the first, actually, to get up and go around, either the Mediterranean or other parts of the known world at that time, which would be, I suppose, the Black Sea and slightly beyond that. And he sort of put the stories together, sometimes three, four versions of the same story. And then he would give you what he sees as the most likely one, or the one he believes.
But he was a Greek with a bit of an agenda, I suppose.
He was. Yes, of course he was pushing the, but not too strongly, For example, he gives us an alternative to the Helen Paris story. He actually tells us that they never got to Troy, according to one. They were stopped, to one of the stories, they were stopped in Egypt on the Nile. The king who gave them shelter said, what's this? He said, you've stolen somebody else's wife. I can't give you passage through my land, because that, besides getting me into a lot of hassle with her husband, thank you, it's not done. So it could all, which means that all the stories we've heard about Troy was made up later on, possibly, we don't know. And I love that even then, but even now I keep reading him, all the horror stories of Arthur and his family, and things, episodes like, you know, when the Persian fleet attacked the Greek fleet, call it Greek, although they were, and there was a prophecy, and then he says, maybe it was a prophecy, or it could be the wind changed.
Yes,
that tiny little
pragmatic.
Maybe you wouldn't call him cynical, but definitely very close to the wind.
He certainly travelled, or at least he gives us the impression that he travelled.
That's one of the big problems. How much of the stuff he gave us was made up by himself, or second-hand, or to an agenda? Funnily enough, however, Tricia, some of the things that people have been going at him for, saying that he made them up and so on, later scholarship has shown that they were true, actually. Many of them were true.
Mm.
So yes. What sounded so outlandish over the years, actually, so he's been vindicated, so to say.
Uh-huh. I was reading, when I was doing a little bit of research for this brushing up on my Herodotus, I noticed there was a story that he recounts about gold-digging ants, which apparently has come up as a sort of possible
we think
true
story. What he got wrong was the geographical position. I think that goes back really, really, really beyond India, or somewhere there. I'm not quite sure about it. But he sort of locates it closer to us. That was his mistake. But the story was there.
Mm.
Yeah, that's true.
He also really sort of lays down the ground rules for future Western historiography.
Yeah.
Really,
Go out there, field work, try to be as objective as you can. He went against the maxim, you know, that history is written by the winner. He might have done that. He was a Greek, after all. He had to survive and so on. But his subversiveness comes in slightly in giving us other versions of the same story, which might not have been the favorites of the ruling king. But he still, like Shakespeare, he just couldn't keep his mouth shut, you know.
In fact, he came in for quite a bit of criticism, even in antiquity.
Oh yes, of course, of course. I mean, they called him some very bad names. I mean, everybody knows this. He's called the father of history, but also the father of lies. Go look at it anywhere you want.
Well, I think we better move on to the next book
we
that you have
stop
on
there
your
forever.
List. Yes, right. Which is, of course, you've chosen the Leopardi, Il Gatto Pardo, Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa. I imagine that this is probably one of those books of the 20th century that most people would put on their list of greats. What is it about the book? What parts of the book resonate with you?
I read that when I was about 27, I think, something like that. I took a lot out of it, but I've read it about 3-4 times since then. Now I'm into my 50s. And funnily enough, Tricia, I've taken different things out of it. Fantastic, when you come to think of it. As an aside, as a writer who tries to double, try to do some writing myself, encouraging to see that that book was refused.
Ooh, yes.
Turned down. Actually, he died before it was printed.
Yes, it's possible.
So it shows you. It gives us people who try to write, put things together, it gives us a sort of boost. But what do you take out of it? It depends, I think, on your age, actually. The first time I read it was the adventure in it, the political scenario, and so on. The sorrow in it as well. I was fascinated by this man who knew that he himself and his class and his family and the class to which he pertained was going out, like one candle after another, like that. And yet he did not lift one tiny little finger to do anything about it. That was fascinating. Later on, of course, at 50 or something like that, there is this thing about this man and the way he faced death, for example, which again is fantastic. So you can, I suppose, read anything out of it. If you are young and romantic, you can go after the romance between Angela and the famous Donna Fogata love story.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
Yes, it is a really it's interesting at so many different levels, and that's obviously what makes it sort of a universal book. And the fact, for us perhaps, that it's it has this Sicilian background,
it's
this Mediterranean feel about it, that perhaps we can connect with as a Mediterranean people.
You get these portraits, fantastic portraits, actually. The priest, for example. My own favorite one is So Is the End, where you had those three elderly ladies living together, two daughters of the prince, and Angela. She's elderly as well, and they live in this old house. It reminds me of my own old aunt, you know. They have these saints, what do you call them? You buy them votives, I don't know what you call. Mm-hmm. Anyway, many of them are fakes. People were really making money off of these three. And then the bishop comes along and says, well, they are not actually all bone that belongs to saints, you know, that sort of thing. It's beautiful. Those portraits are really outstanding. So some people go for it for the history, for example, the Risorgimento and Garibaldi and all that. Different people take different things. That is what fascinates me about the book. Definitely, I have taken different things out of it through my years.
It was somehow also a reflection of his own life. I mean, people often do write in a certain way in an autobiographical
manner.
You always do.
Mm. It's hidden, it's veiled. But yeah, he was the last of his line as well, eh? Giuseppe. So that reflects the situation of the Duke. Mm. And this man who finds escapism in the stars. He was an astrologer of some repute, actually. Mm-hmm.
And he had lost the family home in the American bombing of 1941. Of course. For him, in a way, life was never the same again either, in a different epoch than before.
It wasn't. It was. There are certain similarities between the two protagonists, so to say. Yes, definitely. But yeah, the bombing of the house was the actual last physical step of the dynasty, if you want to call it the dynasty. It was a very minor family, actually, but quite important.
They were part of the aristocracy.
Definitely.
There are definitely parallels with the prince.
And Lampedusa always resonates with us, especially in some.
Yes, exactly. The third book that you mentioned is Ishiguro's The Remains of the Day. This is one of his landmark books, probably also made very popular, of course, by the film,
mm-hmm.
Which was, I think it was a Merchant Ivory production, if I remember rightly, and
Hopkins.
And was actually brilliant with Hopkins and Emma Thompson.
I don't know, I remember. It was a good film, very good film.
It was. And I think the book itself is this very sad and frustrating book in a way, because you've got these people, again, who are sort of living in a bit of a world that isn't quite
not mainstream
anymore.
No.
and it's a bit passé, really, Butler, people don't have butlers anymore. But it was a book that won the Booker Prize in 1989, but it has this end of the journey overview feel about it that doesn't really leave you feeling very positive. And of course I presume that that's what Ishiguro was looking for.
I don't know who said it. I think it was Rushdie who called it beautiful but extremely sad or something. But he used a stronger word than sad. I forgot what it was, but that's it. Now I've got to watch this. We started off with Leonard Cohen. That's from Fabrizio Prince of Lampedusa here. And now we move on to Remains of the Day. Sort of greyish black areas. Well, I suppose that's part of me, but there's another one which is totally different. I'm an extrovert by nature, but sometimes, yes, I do. And now that we've brought them together on a piece of paper, I can see a certain pattern, which is a little bit making me a little bit uneasy.
Disturbing.
What have I revealed about myself? Yeah. But yes, this element of regret, of sadness. Here was this man. He's an Oriental living in London. Although he went there as a child, he still kept that thing. So his style, I like it for the style as well. It's like an onion, you know, a tiny layer, one upon the other like that. Now, and that, I think, is what comes through. This man, what does he insist on calling himself? Dignity. Dignity, I think, the word he keeps using. Dignity is a sort of, how should I say, his idea of how things should be. He's got a code, which to a butler, of course, is a butler. You can't get away from that. It sort of puts you in a box in life, and that's it. And he mentions it so often in the book that I keep getting this feeling that he actually has misgivings about it. How do you say it in Italian?
La lingua batte dove il dente duole.
I think that he knew about it. He knew what he was missing out at, all the price that he was paying for following that sort of dignified life where he total loyalty to Darlington, Lord Darlington, and so on, to a way of life which was passé, as you said. Not for them, though. Eh? It was caught right in the middle when it started off. Then, 56, the novel is set in 56. By that time, yes, it was passé. But before that, there was still, it was still quite strong between the two wars, say, for example. Until finally, he hit a brick wall. He had to come face to face with reality. And this happens during that 6 or 7 day trip where he went looking for what possibly could have been his love, Miss Kenton. Possibly. And because that's it. It's all full of possibilities, which never take root. But coming to the stage in his life when he did, when we meet him in the book, of course, is going to crowd him in. And yet he can't think of anything better to do than he starts crying, of course, which, of course, for him, I mean, stiff upper lip and all that. I mean, it was something for him.
Beyond the pale.
Yeah, extreme. So. But he can't actually deny what he has been asserting throughout his life. So the best he can do is, he said, oh yeah, I have to improve my bantering, I think he calls it, bantering.
Which is, he has this new
American,
new American.
What's his name? Faraday.
He banters with him and he realizes way, ribbing, he doesn't know how to banter.
He doesn't know. He's too serious. He takes himself and what he believes in too seriously. That's what led to breaking off with Miss Kenton in the first place. This sort of, she was more open, more ready for life, actually. There is a life outside there. Mm. I mean, if your sons and my son and daughter have had met this guy, they would have told him in the modern jargon, go get a life.
Because she had actually got a life.
Even the disappointment. But that was part of it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He has never got out of the box.
No.
Get a life. I mean.
Well, I think we can continue on this very happy
sort of
itinerary with J.M. Coetzee's Disgrace. Yeah.
Uh-huh, another one. Oh,
which,
my God.
I think the comment I made when I was jotting down some words about each of these books was, this book is certainly not a bag of laughs.
Oh, it's an
exclamation mark. It's a post-apartheid narrative, which really brings to mind the expression sort of brutal and miserable.
Oh,
really.
Gritty. Mm. It is.
So, but it's an important book, and it is actually considered to be an important post-apartheid narrative.
Yeah. In a way, he's like the prince in The Leopard. The man is the symbol of his times. The prince was the symbol of a word which was coming to an end, and this man, David, and his daughter, Lucy, and how they have to step into new relations with the people who, the colored people in Africa, in South Africa. It's a new world they have to step into. And he suddenly finds himself so inadequate to do that.
I mean, yes, he doesn't have the tools, really.
Doesn't have to, of course, partly because In spite of being a very intelligent man, he was never ready for it. He lived for the day in his old life, and he was totally unprepared. It's a beautiful for me. It's because my daughter was growing up at the time, so there was this beautiful. She gets raped, and actually carries a colored man's baby. We know that, and he hazards to tell her what to do, and she turns on him and says, "It's my life. I'm no longer one of your caste. This is another place, sort of thing. Forget this." So yeah, it does come across. Again, this man has caused controversy, big controversy. Was he a selfish, self-absorbed man, or wasn't he? Well, he finishes up looking after dogs, killing them if need be, mercifully, and burning them, possibly even a symbol of himself, who's going to burn him. He's a sensualist. He's had women in his life. He gets into trouble because of
that. So it becomes really off the rails with the student.
Yeah. Melanie, which happens to be my daughter's name, but I didn't know that at the time, of course. he's got a touch of the Socrates in him. They offer him a way out, and he refuses it. A compromise, sort of. The university offers him that, but he refuses that. And he lives to regret it. At times, and he lives to be proud of it. At other times, you know how it is. We all do that as we go along. But yes, he was an attractive man. He's in his 50s, so that resonates with me, again, of course. And he had relatively younger women before. And one of the adjustments he has to make is he's a man in the 50s. Has to readjust politically, socially, sexually, whatever, with his family. And he does it in a way very, very, very nicely. He's obsessed with this study of Byron. He wants to put together a sort of biography, but also a critical study of Byron, which he keeps putting off, and circumstances make it very difficult for him to carry on with, and so on. And there are, of course, parallels between Byron, we know that he was sexually rather active, like this man, and having to come to adjust. And Byron put the 30-year mark as the sort of thing when, I suppose, when if you, all teenagers and young people think that it is quite obscene that people have sexual relations after the age of 30, I suppose. I mean, it's unimaginable. Unimaginable. Again, I'm sorry. I mean, I've realized now what my pick means. There is a certain common element with the other books, so this thing of regret and adjustment.
Perhaps the last book on the list, the Le Carré, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, perhaps. Although that is quite, in some ways, a bleak narrative of human relations, maybe it's a slightly different story. Do you go for that sort of spy genre, or is this a sort of one-off choice because it's such a classic book?
No. I've read all Le Carré's books, including the more recent ones, which are not spy. The mission song, for example, is not a spy. Although there is a high finance in it, which is as dirty as anything you can get in the spy business. But first of all, I like his prose. It's great. He manages to explain and put down things to a level when you're writing, where you're either writing a thesis. Or you manage somehow to incorporate it and smelt it and melt it down into something in the form of a novel, which is not an easy thing to do. McEwan does that as well. He's able to take the philosophy, and even Julian Barnes does it. So you have to explain, but he do it in such a way that people don't say, "Oh my God, he's talking down to me." No, he manages. And the world he portrays is murky, as you say. It's full of these, one-winged personalities. They're all crippled in some way. game.
It's like a sort of billiard game where you're hitting one ball that has to hit the side of the billiard table so that it comes back to hit another one. You know, you're never quite sure beginning which one you're aiming, which one the billiard player is aiming at.
Most people in the playwriting business actually point this out, this book, as a sort of thing, one of those books that people should keep in front of their eyes if they are writing plays, because it's the twist within the twist, and that's worked very nicely on stage, very nicely. Once I was told by somebody that Le Carré is very good, he's almost literature. I said, what the hell do you mean by this sort of snobby, very snobbish actually, attitude. He is literature, if you want to look at it. Who's want to put down the cut off? He's great. His language is great. His psychology is great. He just happens to talk about, or used to, because as we said, towards the end, his latest books are not like that. A very limited sort of environment. But apart from that, I mean, he's hard hitting. He's become very, very, very. He talks about AIDS medicine now.
He's extremely deep, bloomed, deep writer. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time.
Oh, really?
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Vincent Bella, for coming to talk to us about these five fascinating books. Thank you so much.
My guest today was Vincent Bella. I do hope that you can join me again next week for another edition of Talking Books. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.